This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You know what it is that makes it hard on this show, the show that I'm already recording now, is that I don't like to say welcome back Lucha Lushes on the interview show when I know that my guests might possibly not drink. It makes me feel awkward. And, like, I know that my guest tonight actually, I think, falls into that category. My guest tonight is... I was supposed to ask you how to pronounce your last name before this part got awkward.
I was wondering if you knew.
It's Brock Yankee, right?
Yonkee.
Okay, very Yonkee. Close.
Like the thing you do when you're tired and what opens doors. Which is a sleep knob.
Oh, I was like, a Yonkee. Very confusing here.
I think the name is German, if anyone is wondering about that. I don't know a whole lot about my family history, like past like two or three generations, but I believe the name is German.
My last name is also German, but it's not, I guess, a real last name, which is nice.
Okay.
It's an assumed we came to America and we don't want our debts to follow us last name, which is nice.
Totally.
Which is not uncommon. And tonight, special guest co-host.
Oh, whoa.
This we do from time to time. Rather than Adrian filling in, we have former guest of the podcast, former host of me personally, Tom Batista from... Wow, I'm blanking on the name of your show. I am really bad tonight. I'm sorry about that. The Military Industrial Suplex is what it's actually called.
Military Industrial Suplex. Thank you for the introduction, Tim. Jay Biggs was the name of Clarence Mason's character.
Oh, that's what we were talking about. Okay.
In WCW.
That's it. Jay Biggs. Why did they... That is so WCW to... And I have to just say it. To go, like, so stereotypical black. Like, they made him have a rapper's name when his character is a lawyer.
Yeah.
Which is...
Jay Biggs.
Very WCW. I guess part of why I'm stumbling around myself, I'll just go out there and put it out there first. I've interviewed guests. I've had guests who I look up to a lot before. That's normal. But the part of this episode that's making me very nervous is this is probably the first time I've done a podcast where I really feel like I'm the least intelligent person on the call.
That cannot be true.
Well, a lot of times I have Adrian.
Okay.
So he's always bringing up the rear.
I mean, I think I've listened to Tom talk before and I've read some of his stuff. I think Tom is a very intelligent person, but Tim, you've known me for many months now and you can't possibly think that's true.
Oh, yo, you are much too humble, Brock. And to get into that, I guess we'll start out with the opening question and then we'll get into your humbleness. But Brock, are you now or have you ever been a member of the PWO board?
Yes, and if we had done this, I mean, even just a couple months ago, I would have to say no to that. I want to say I joined the board back in July of 2016 after lurking for a long time. I don't believe my account was even officialized for 3 months after that. I had to, like, message Lost on Twitter and be like, hey, can I get on the board? And he's like, oh, yeah, sure. Sorry about that. I think as of today, I was posting a lot today. I think as of today, I only have like 14 posts on the board. So I'm still very new and I just lurk around a lot. I don't necessarily post too much, though. It's funny. I've known about PWO, I think, for quite a while now. I browsed a lot of wrestling forums back in college, back in like 2011 and 2012. And I think I stumbled upon PWO via the Is TNA the Worst Promotion of All Time thread, because I remember finding a similar thread of like huge length. It's not as big as it is today, but like still something like 20, 30, 40 pages. And I think I remember finding certain avatars or certain usernames familiar when I stumbled back into PWO on like March of 2016. As of late, I've only recently joined the scene.
Okay. And I mean, that could have also even been something along the lines of like Smart's Choice or DVDVR, depending
totally
on the time frame.
I know for a fact that I was on DVDVR for a while, but it's just there were so many of them that they sort of all blend together.
Right. And you talked about being on different boards early on, and you kind of went into that, which I'm going to give you credit there, Brock. Perfect answer of the question, because that's what I want. I want to hear about your background when I'm asking about that as well. So other guests, be forewarned. Brock did it exemplary. But one thing that you're kind of well known for, and when I mentioned that you were the guest, the first thing that we'll say, a mysterious PTBN benefactor wanted me to talk about backyard wrestling. You're well known for your backyard wrestling history. Did that, would you say backyard wrestling came first, or the online wrestling community came first for you, or would you say that they're pretty intertwined?
It's a little bit of both, though. I guess then that answer would be that they are intertwined. I first stumbled into professional wrestling on Christmas Day of 2007. If you want to talk about that more, we can talk about that here in a minute. But I very quickly got into the internet wrestling community quickly thereafter, because I was just so – I was a teenager. I was getting into wrestling later than a lot of people do. And I was so hungry for something. I just wanted to, like, sink my teeth into something as a teenager. I was becoming disenfranchised with religion. I didn't have a lot of friends. I liked art, and I liked cinema, and I liked literature, but, like, nothing was, I don't know, nothing was, like, scratching the itch that I needed. And so I found wrestling, and it didn't really, like, kick off right away, but I could tell that there was something more to it, and I wanted to find out more of it. This was the era of, like, everything getting uploaded to YouTube, and Wikipedia was becoming a big thing, and there was still, like, you could still get on Angel Fire back in those days, and I just took to the internet, and I found as much wrestling information as I could, and I read everything. I watched as much as I could. Like, I read about stuff from Japan and Mexico and Europe before I even got to know what, like, WCW was. And through that process of becoming a wrestling fan, I was introduced to a couple of kids in my class in high school who were wrestling fans. And I wasn't necessarily friends with them at the time. Like, I knew them as wrestling people. And as I got more into wrestling myself, I kind of grew closer with them. And I found out that they did what they called backyard wrestling. And I was like, I don't know what this is. And they were showing me, like, this website that they made where they, like, typed up all the results of all their shows. And it sounded like so underground and so gritty and so weird, but it was alluring. And so like, I go over to this kid's house one day and they're just they're rolling around on the grass and giving each other gonzo bombs without knowing what those moves are, and like doing all sorts of dangerous things that we didn't realize were dangerous at the time. But it was something that was really attractive to me, to be like, oh, I want to replicate the sort of thing that I love, that I see in professional wrestling. And when I got into, like, art, or when I got into not so much cinema, because I didn't have a camera, I couldn't go out and, like, film things, but when I got into writing, I was like, oh, I want to kind of replicate this. And that pen and paper isn't very expensive, so, like, you can do that on your own, but with wrestling you need people. And so I found these people, and I was quickly able to replicate what I loved in professional wrestling, which essentially is just backyard wrestling. And it all grew from there.
So, Brock, I have a question. So, obviously, you tried to do your Brad Maddox thing. That didn't work out. You didn't have the equipment. But December 25th, you found your new religion, your new religion of professional wrestling. What exactly happened on the 25th? Were you given a bunch of Jack's Pacific toys under the Christmas tree? Or how did that come about? Why that day?
I don't believe I've ever actually owned a wrestling toy. I own precious little wrestling memorabilia as it is. I grew up very poor, and so I tend to not live with a lot, and I don't collect a lot of things because of that. But to answer your question, we kind of have to go back to a couple months before that, and it's the summer of 2017. It's the summer of 2007, and I believe it's a this is a Monday. This is a Monday during the summer, and I'm with my mother at the grocery store. She's just, like, running in to grab some quick things. We're going to leave after that. And I'm sitting in the van, and I'm listening to the radio. And the news comes on, and there's the story of, like, this weirdo, like, Canadian professional wrestler I'd never heard of who, like, murdered his wife and child and skirted all responsibility. And they said his name, and I was like, that name sounds... Oh, yeah, this is Chris Benoit. And it was a name I knew because my brother was into professional wrestling, and he had been for several years at that point. And before that, like, I always, I mentioned I was, like, a teenager. And I was just like an angry young kid for a variety of reasons that I'm sure we can get into if you want to. But I kind of lashed out against my brother because like he was watching this thing that I didn't understand, and it sort of played on my like my burgeoning sexuality at that point. I didn't understand yet that I was like a bisexual person, and seeing these kind of people, it was like it stirred something in me, and that was frightening, and there was a whole bunch of like just animosity, and I lashed out against the person who was closest to me, my little brother. And I was like, oh, this wrestling. And granted, like, I don't endorse these things that I'm saying. And it's just to give an example. But I was like, oh, this wrestling's, you know, fake and gay. Like, why do you like it? And I was just sort of a dick to my little brother because he loved professional wrestling. And so then I hear Chris Benoit, like, killed himself and he killed his family. And we didn't have internet at our house. We didn't have cable at our house. We had, like, they still had analog TV back then. So we had a pair of bunny ears. We'd put on the back of the television, sort of like steal like two fuzzy black and white channels from our neighbor. So like we weren't connected to the world, especially not in like the summer when we weren't going to school and talking to people who had like cable and who had the internet. So I return home on a Monday night and I tell my brother like, oh, hey, this wrestler you like died. And he didn't believe me at first and was like, no, this sounds like a story. They did a thing with Vince last week. Like they've killed people before, or like Road Warrior, Animal, or Hawk. I don't remember which one it was. And so he really brushed it off. But I was like, this was on the news, dude. Like he totally killed some people, and it really affected him. He didn't love Benoit, but it was the first time that like someone had really died in wrestling for him. He came in like shortly after Guerrero, so he'd never got that sort of experience. And it really affected him, and I kept pushing it just because I was a dumb teenager and I was like, oh, this is getting a reaction from a person, and I want to keep pushing these buttons because, you know, it gives me a rush. And eventually like drove him to tears, and like he didn't talk to me for 2 days and whatever. So fast forward to Christmas of 2007, and he gets what was it? It was No Way Out 2007 on DVD, and he was going to pop it into our DVD player and watch it there on Christmas Day. And in a brotherly moment that became more common between the two of us as we got older, and I'm very thankful for that. He turns to me and he's like, hey, do you want to watch this with me and maybe like get to know why I like wrestling? And it occurred to me that like all those months before I had like ridiculed him and like attacked him with the Benoit news, and I sort of wanted to make it up to him, and I was like, you know what, yeah, sure, I'm gonna sit down and watch it with you. And like No Way Out 2007 is I think you could call it an objectively bad show, but like there's stuff on it that I like. There's like matches and segments that I like, and there's stuff on it that I can pinpoint as kicking off like my love affair with professional wrestling. Guys like John Cena, guys like the aforementioned Benoit, guys like Matt Hardy, who were like really central to my understanding of professional wrestling early on. And that's where it all grew from, was No Way Out 2007.
That is a summer. Oh, I'm sorry. You want
to go ahead,
Tim? Oh, okay. I was just going to say that's a summer that will make Bryan Adams proud. You debuted as a heel, and a few months later, you turned face.
Yes, I did.
So it's a very Bret and Owen moment, bonding mm-hmm. over spandex, Roar to Rage, and Vince McMahon promos. So very uh-huh. interesting start. I think it's really interesting that because a lot of the Benoit murders turned mm-hmm. a lot of people off from wrestling.
Totally,
and
yeah.
I just find that interesting that because you're the first person who, now you obviously didn't directly say it, but you know, it acted as a catalyst in mm-hmm. some way of piquing your interest into something that you brushed off for a very long time for a variety of reasons. Is it the aspect that, is it that backstage aspect that really captured your attention about it? Do you still follow the business and the news of the business more so than the actual performance and everything that happens on air?
I wouldn't say more so, but you're not necessarily wrong in that line of thinking. I think partially due to the fact that I got into it later in life than most people. I wasn't a child when I first approached professional wrestling, and partially due to the fact that at that time I was just becoming a lot smarter as a person, and I was being more opened up into art and especially things like theater. And I'd begun like acting around that time. And it attracted me because like I quickly began to realize it wasn't trying to be sports, which it was something I was very much not into at that point in my life, though I've become more receptive to it these days. It wasn't trying to be sports. It was trying to be a certain form of performance art. And that was something I could be very much interested in. And I was also interested in like the minutiae of what goes on with that and how you make that work behind the scenes. It was always like really interesting to me to watch a really good movie and then go on the special features and watch like the making of documentary. That was something that was very, very attractive to me as a young person trying to absorb as much art as I could and then also understand it.
Now, this is kind of interesting. I mean, it's very interesting to me, honestly, as you're talking about 2007s when you're first being exposed to professional wrestling, and it is after Benoit died, and then becoming a fan of Benoit after his death seems very... it's weird to say his death, I guess. Maybe I should say after he sure. murdered his family and committed suicide. But that doesn't yes. roll off the tongue as easily. it's weird to think of becoming him a fan of his after that. And then as I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking about your age range at that time. You wouldn't have started backyard wrestling before you were a fan of wrestling, unless you're just like one of the weirdest dudes on the planet.
No.
Which, I mean, you might be, but just not that weird. And so I'm thinking on 2007, well, how old was I? And I think I probably had my last backyard wrestling match around the same time that you got exposed to wrestling. So mm-hmm. it's so funny to think, I mean, you're not, you know, a decade younger than me, but you kind of came into it a decade after I was done, almost in that way, like with a lot of this stuff. Now you talked a little bit about the backstage aspect of maybe the Benoit tragedy being a catalyst for you, but what about, let's just say, the turmoil and the anguish of the situation? As you said, it was performance art, but you had some tough times. You talk about being poor. You talk about your home life. In some ways, did you find that knowing that something that tragic could happen in this arena almost kind of drew you to it as well?
I wouldn't put it in such eloquent words, but I there's some truth to what you're saying with that. I think it was... it wasn't something that I liked, but it was something that I understood about professional wrestling, that professional wrestlers weren't necessarily good people. And especially in the hindsight of the Benoit murders, we're looking at 10 years later now. It's hard for certain people to return to a lot of those matches because you're watching a murderer do his work. And he's not yet a murderer, but he's a person who will grow into be a murderer. And that's a very difficult thing for people to swallow. And I understand that. And I get that mentality behind it. Some of my best friends are people who can't watch those matches anymore because of like what he's done. And I'm empathetic to that. But I think to bring it back down to my home life that you brought up, like I grew up in an abusive home, and like, when you do that, you kind of like, not all the days are bad, you know what I mean? And it's not every day that you're getting your ripped in half like I did when I was like 4 years old. It's life, and life has good days and bad days, and the people in those lives have good days and bad days. So like, my parents aren't terrible people, but they were people who did terrible things. And like, I kind of had to like struggle with that as I got older. I had to struggle with the fact that my dad wasn't someone who always like flew into a rage and attacked people. And he wasn't always someone who like distanced himself from my family by like being a truck driver or going off to school and leaving us all alone. Like he was a guy struggling with his life. And as I've gotten older, and as I wouldn't say followed in his footsteps, but like become a similar person in some ways, like I've come to understand that. And in a similar way, I frame professional wrestling, that like sometimes these terrible people who do terrible things to each other make something that like affects me on an emotional level. And that's hard to just, that's as hard to forget about as the fact that some of these people are murderers and are rapists and have done all sorts of horrible things.
Right, and I think there's kind of not that hero worship aspect in some ways for you, which I think is so rare. I mean, constantly, and I hearken to it here, and you know, there's private jokes between people in group chats that are just terrible and really, sure, really bad, but you still see people, even it's as if there isn't like a post, because I mean Guerrero was also a big hit too, so like kind of that 1-2 punch where you say there isn't really like a post Guerrero Benoit world where now every wrestling fan is no longer innocent no matter what age they are. I mean, there are still new wrestling fans today who find out that, you know, a wrestler said the N-word and are like, not sure, him, I'm a huge fan of him, he would never do that. And it, for you, that was, I can't imagine that ever crossed your mind when the context of wrestlers is Benoit, yeah, tragedy. So for
and
very you, much,
and on top of that, like I absorbed so much of my wrestling not through watching it on TV, but reading about it on the internet. So that context was always there. Like I've always been someone who, I don't know, the internet was very much always a part of my wrestling fandom, and like the knowledge that comes with that has always been part of my wrestling fandom.
And I think Tom, did you have
about? Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. I just wanted to chime in again, just listening to everything Brox is saying. I just find it really interesting that it seems that because of your rough upbringing, that you didn't really get lost in the violence and ballyhoo of pro wrestling. As someone who, that I hate to say, a more privileged, because I definitely wasn't privileged growing up.
Sure.
In a in this situation, if we want to talk about a more normal, if you will, no disrespect to you.
No, don't.
Oh yeah, no problem.
But well, to be fair, I think we can all. Oh, sorry.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I just want to say that in a more normal upbringing, a lot of people gravitate towards pro wrestling for their escapism. I know I did. Mm. And I find it really interesting when you said a lot of wrestlers are bad people that just happen to do acting. And you felt as though, again, in the summer, doing your heel a bit, essentially being a bad person, being a bad guy in your life, and yet you love acting. And so I find those parallels just really interesting. My question to you, again, not to really harp on this, but the upbringing that you had, how did you transition into the person that you are today? Because with an upbringing like that, and I know friends who've had hard lives through domestic abuse and violence and whatever it may be, what would you tell someone who's listening to this podcast of how they can cope with that, how they can move past that, what they can do to begin to normalize their lives, and more importantly, work to not repeat the process, because there's always the saying that the abuse, and it doesn't seem like you're that type of person. Obviously, the cycle stopped with you, but if there's anyone listening to this podcast, what advice would you give them?
It's sort of a difficult question to answer, partially because, like, it's hard to say that when you grow up, not just as someone who was abused, but someone who just had hardship of any variety, really, of which, like, there are many, many, many more things worse than what I had to grow up with. Like, I can't imagine the unspeakable things that I never had to struggle through, despite the fact that I still, in the same way, struggled. When you grow up as someone who suffers that sort of thing, you don't just magically wake up one day and it's all better. Like, it sticks with you. You're gonna carry that weight, to paraphrase one of the few anime that I actually like. You sort of just learn to live with it sometimes. And the sad fact of life is that some people never learn to live with it, and it takes them to the grave. Like, that's just a very real situation in life, that, like, some people never get over the things that happened to them, and God bless all those people who struggled and couldn't find a way out, because, you know what, like, they did nothing wrong in that situation. But, like, all I can say is, like, most of the times in life, not always, and like you have to be that sort of realist, but like most of the times in life, things just do get better, and you have to just hold on and wait for them to do that and work towards making things better in your life, whatever way you can, whether that's through, you know, whether that's through positivity, whether that's through education, whether that's through like sports. Sports is a big thing people lose themselves in, and it gets them out of shitty situations sometimes. But like the only way that the situation will always get worse is if you're dead. And like, if you're still alive, there's always that chance. And so you have to stay alive.
That makes sense, and nice words. And one of the ways to escape as well, Cowboy Bebop.
Sure.
The reference. So for all the anime nerds out there, score one for me.
Not a huge anime guy. Like there's problems with the medium that I don't like too much, but there's definitely good anime out there.
Well, let's go ahead and discuss that then. Let's switch gears. So Cowboy Bebop, one of the things that I really love about that show is the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Music's and delightful.
Exactly. And so when you start taking a look at Cowboy Bebop and some of the other compositions done by the composer for Wolf's Rain and other anime, really, in my genre, in my style of music, I'm really enjoying it. What got you into anime? And not only what got you into anime, more specifically to Cowboy Bebop, but what do you not like about the genre? Because it obviously sounds like, based off what you just said, that there was a lot, or that there is a lot, that is preventing you from fully diving in. But there's something about this show that you said, all right, the Cowboy Bebop is fine. Everything else, I don't want to see it, and I don't want to deal with it.
Well, so I grew up in the 90s, and in the 90s, children's programming, specifically things like Cartoon Network, began to understand that, holy shit, Japanese animation is really popular with a certain demographic of people, so why don't we start showing that? And so growing up, I have like fond memories of watching Toonami in the middle of the night while my parents were asleep, because even though like insomnia hadn't destroyed my life at that point yet, it's so odd to think back on. Like, there were warning signs the whole time, but like even as a child, I had trouble sleeping sometimes, so I'd just like sneak into the living room and like turn on the TV and like watch the Mighty Ducks TV show, or Space Ghost Coast to Coast, which is like one of my passions in life, or I'd watch anime when it was on. Gundam Seed, I think one of the Gundams was very popular at the time, and I watched a bunch of that. There was like, you know, your Dragon Ball, your Yu Yu Hakusho, which I really enjoy, the usual sort of stuff. So that was like my first introduction into anime, but I never had like, I don't know, I never really had a strong love for it then. It was just something that I was on, and I was like, okay, I'll watch this. And a couple years later, I started to get really into art for a variety of reasons, one of which was video games, and specifically video game art from games like Pokemon and Castlevania and Final Fantasy and Street Fighter, especially. I forget the name of it because it's got a hugely complicated name, but there's a GBA port of SF2 that's like Super Street Fighter Hyper Turbo 2 or something, and it has like just beautiful, gorgeous promotional art that like leapt off the page at me, and I was like, I wanna draw like that. I wanna create images that look like that. That's so cool to me. And so as I'm getting more into art, and especially that sort of like video gaming art style, it leads me back in anime, and it leads me into manga. And I really enjoyed manga because it was beautiful, not just in an artistic sense, but like some of the stories that you'd read in manga, it was just something that like, especially for a juvenile version of myself, it was very attractive. But as I got into anime, it was like the animation wasn't so great most of the time, and part of that's just like an economic problem, that like these people have to put out shows at such an alarming rate and with such a small like crew that like you can't put in the sort of love that you get out of like, say, manga, for example. And part of it's like some of those stories they tell are like just immature, and they're not something that like is attractive to me anymore. A big part of it is like when I love One Piece. One Piece is like a very central thing in my life. I've read the manga of One Piece, which is like well over 1,000 chapters at this point. I absolutely adore it. And like, as I'm 700-800 chapters into One Piece, and I'm like, hey, I should probably watch the manga because it's, or I should probably watch the anime since it's here. Getting into that and hearing the way that they thought characters should sound was very jarring to me. And like, that's a little thing, but like the voice acting was a weird thing I didn't like. I don't know. There's a lot of like small reasons why I don't like anime, and they all come together and create this big overall problem. It's not something like, oh, I hate cartoons or for kids. It's a lot of little nitpicks.
Yeah, I think I have not really similar, but I have similar, I guess is the word. I have gripes that are in of the same vein. It's not necessarily the overall reason why I don't keep up with anime, I guess, is what I meant to say there. Because it's just, I guess I'd rather watch wrestling is kind of why I don't. That sounds fucking crazy, but I mean, it is. It's just kind of the truth about me with how much wrestling I watch. But you touched on something there when you talked about the issues with insomnia, and for me, like my wife fucking hates me because I can fall asleep in like 2 seconds and then I snore the entire bedroom out. But when I was young, like everyone, I kind of did the stay up late, and almost like some people with eating disorders where it's not about a body dysmorphic thing, it's about a control thing. That was kind of the staying up late. It was my time. I was up when I wasn't supposed to be. Do you think there was any of that, or do you think it is, like, do you have trouble sleeping, or was there a psychological component to you, you think, outside of that?
There's a little bit of both. There was definitely points in my life, especially as, like, a teenager, in which I would specifically try to stay up later, or more often than not, get up earlier. I'd get up at, like, 5 a.m. when I was going to school at, like, 8 o'clock. There was definitely an element to that where I was like, this is my time. This is time that like I can be by myself in a quiet house and just sort of like do whatever I want and be with myself. And I don't have to worry about what I'm doing in front of other people. And there's something very true about that statement. But at the same time, there simply is like a medical problem with me in that like, more often than not, I can't sleep, or I have trouble staying asleep, or like my body doesn't fall asleep when it should, like when I'm exhausted. You're not wrong that there's a little bit of both, but like there are a lot of problems. There's a lot of problems that are going on with me.
The cure for insomnia, Seth Rollins matches.
Oh.
Brock, did you see Triple H versus Seth Rollins at WrestleMania? And if so, what are your thoughts?
I was an unfortunate victim of WrestleMania 33, as well as that match in particular. It's funny, we were talking about anime earlier because a lot of people were disparaging that match for its heavy-handed tones in its storytelling and describing it as an anime match, especially with how Rollins looked. Yeah, I watched it. I didn't... A lot of times when I watch wrestling and I'm not specifically reviewing it, like I wasn't on that show, I don't necessarily give too much critical thought to it. So it's sort of just like I watched that show passively, and I was more concerned with like talking to my friends on Twitter and having a good time on this 8-hour show. So like I watched it and I didn't like it because I'm not a fan of those two, and their sorts of matches generally do very little for me. But you know what? I couldn't tell you why exactly I hated it.
You know, WrestleMania for a lot of people was definitely the story of two halves. WrestleMania, for what it was pretty good all the way until the proposal finished. And after that, the show just took a nosedive. And I find it really interesting that the main matches outside of the SmackDown women's match and outside of Goldberg-Lesnar, those three matches had different stories going into it versus what was being communicated with inside the ring and in some cases after. And in the Seth Rollins match, my biggest problem with that is with a lot of people is you're going into the match and you're talking about the knee and you're questioning the knee and everyone wants to know what's going on with the knee, and Rollins is limping to the ring. And then next thing you know, he's doing a sunset powerbomb spot, the same spot that where he legit injured himself earlier. And then all of a sudden, he's doing deadlift spots where he's running across the ring into powerbomb Triple H and Buckles, and he's doing the Phoenix Splash, and he's doing all this stuff that just really puts a lot of pressure and focus on the knee. So it's really weird because and that was the biggest problem to me with the end of WrestleMania, the second half, if you will, WrestleMania 33 Electric Boogaloo, where they just didn't care about the stories that were told prior to the match, and everybody just wanted to have that crazy quote-unquote WrestleMania moment.
Yeah, that was one thing that's been talked about a lot recently with the IWGP heavyweight title matches Okada has been having, that on some level, like, regardless of what sort of story they're telling in the ring, like, you're always going to have to see a certain variety of moves and certain big spots, because like they're the big spots that supposedly bring in the fans, and they're here to see that, and they paid their money to see that. And you gotta wonder, like, if that mentality is actually prevalent in these promotions, because like what's going on if that's not the answer?
Well, the thing is, Okada, he's just trying to get his Wrestle Kingdom moment, and you're not going to take that away from Brock.
I guess.
Not you and not anyone.
Gato's booking for the casuals and not me.
I'm just like got so many thoughts going through my head after everything. I haven't watched all of WrestleMania, unfortunately. Haven't gotten around to it. Just can't find the time for the 8 hours. But it does sound like you'd definitely be foolish to be trying to follow Big Matrimony John. Like that was kind of the hardship for the second half of the show, it seems. And the other part of it too must have just been that they saw Omega and Okada, and as I had heard the rumor went around, they wanted to have a match that was like that, but they picked up the wrong part and they went for the anime route of Omega's thing. The idea that they have to hit the spots because the crowd wants to see it, and I've kind of said this here and there, but that's, you know, Ric Flair's thing is he said that. He said he went to see Ray Stevens. Ray Stevens didn't do some spots that he liked, and he went home sad and confused because he was a dumb child.
What a mark.
Yeah, and if you talk to, you know, Nick Bockwinkel or Terry Funk, they have the opposite psychology, which is you're telling the fans the story. They don't dictate what you do. And you shouldn't worry about that they're not going to be happy because they didn't see these spots. Now, you know, that's two different schools of thought. Who's to say who's right and who's wrong in that regard? But you know what's definitely right is us going to a break right now.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStationNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, so we're back from break, and Brock, I mean, there's, goddamn, there's been so much that we're supposed to talk about, but it feels so much more fun just talking.
We're just having a conversation as friends.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing is, we talk about different schools of thought or when it comes to wrestling, but I have different schools of thought when it comes to podcasting, which is like there's the Colt Cabana, and people say, oh, Colt Cabana is such a good interviewer because it feels like he's having a conversation. And I stop and go, that's not an interview. So he's not a good interviewer because he doesn't interview the guests, which is like kind of my thing is I like to feel like more of an interviewer and less of a conversation. But it does get hard when you're talking to someone who you just want to talk to. And I don't like you snickering at the double entendre there. Sir, I could hear it.
That's how I was snickering at your situation, not so much your wordplay.
Ah, gotcha. It was not intentional. But yeah, it does become that situation. It becomes difficult to kind of bridge the two worlds, or the two schools of thought in the podcast. But I guess just for banter's purposes, people want to hear about your backyard stuff. But I mean, you know, I don't want to hear about it that much, honestly. Like your life situation is always interesting to me, and I feel like you're not a person who doesn't put it all out there, but it's kind of not all out there. So
it's funny how you said that to me as we were talking about like what this podcast was going to be and when we were going to record and all that jazz. You said that to me, and I was like, it's weird because I consider myself an open book. It's just like I'm not a crazy person on the subway, and I'm not telling you my life story like apropos of nothing. It's just. I guess you need someone to ask.
Exactly. And that's the point of this show. And that's why I say the thing about Colt Cabana. It's like a lot of times you listen to the Colt Cabana show or even, you know, Morgan Webster or whoever it is. But after it's done, you go like, I don't know anything about that person. I just know about their relationship and that they're friends with each other and maybe a couple things here and there. But a lot of times it doesn't feel like you get into them because people do need to be asked or else they don't talk about it. And just like you say, you know, you feel like you're an open book and you mention stuff here and there, but no one ever takes the time to really get into it. And that was the point of this show for me was getting that part of people's lives. So you talk about, you've mentioned possibly being homeless at times. What's the timeline like? When do you, because I figure with the lifestyle or with the background that you have, you were like me and you were just like champing at the bit to get out of the parents' house. When do you get out of there? When do you almost become homeless? What age are you doing all that stuff?
Well, I was, I've actually been homeless twice. Okay. Once when I was, it's hard to get the timeline right of like the first 10 years of my life because, I mentioned that we were poor. We were poor because my parents are very bad decision makers. And specifically, my mother is very bad with money, which is weird because she came from like just a working class family. Like my grandfather worked in a book factory his entire life. It's not like she was like a really privileged person and didn't know the value of money. She just, I don't know, she just wasn't super great with it and still isn't today. We were super poor, and part of being super poor was that this is going to sound outrageous, and some of the math in this is a little wonky, so hear me out. Before I turned 17 years old, we had lived in 17 different houses in my life. Now, one of those houses was the car that we lived in while we were homeless. One of those houses is a hotel that we lived in like for like 2 or 3 weekends during the 2 month period of time in which I was homeless at like 8 years old. One of those houses was like my grandparents' house where we lived as we transitioned from homelessness into having a home for the first time in a couple months. But like a lot of my childhood was moving from house to house because like we were behind on bills and we couldn't pay off the things that we were supposed to be paying off, and we were running from taxes and just trying to keep a move on, living a very I don't want to like compare my experience to that of someone else, but like people have heard me tell this story before and were like, oh, you sound like a Romani person, like one of the Romani, or is it Ramoni people?
The Ramones, the punk band.
Yes, they the punk band.
Changed their last name to Ramone and
yes.
Do heroin at the Bowery. No, Romani, the, what are they called? Romanian. Gypsies.
Not Romanian, but gypsies, I think, is a pejorative term.
Yeah, you're not supposed to call them that, but that's what people...
Yeah.
I think it's, I've heard it pronounced both ways, but Romani is the way I hear it most commonly.
Okay. But people had compared me to, like, the Romani people before, and there's some truth to that, that like I was just constantly on the move. And so somewhere along in there, we're living in an apartment complex, and we've got a couple cats, and we weren't supposed to have cats, and our landlord was always like, hey, you're not supposed to have cats, get those fucking cats out of there. And we didn't listen to him for a very long time, and we're also behind on bills. And one day we're eating dinner, and I get up to answer the door and open the door. There's two cops there with my landlord, and they're like, you got 10 minutes to get out of the house. And we grabbed a bunch of clothing and got in the van and drove away. And that was the beginning of us being homeless. And it started, let's see this timeline of this. Started, I think, in September of 2001, which is a delightful time in American history, and lasted for about 2 months until just before the end of October, because I remember somewhere along the way we got McDonald's. We had a lot of fast food at the time because, like, spoilers, you can't fucking cook when you're homeless. We had a McDonald's at one point. My brother and I both got, like, Happy Meal toys, and some of them were, like, toys for Monsters, Inc., which I think debuted on, like, November 4th of that year. So for 2 months, we were just sort of going to school. What we would do was, like, we were very lucky to have a van. Like, a lot of homeless people don't even have that much, and we were very, very fortunate to have a means of transportation as well as a little bit of cash, as well as fucking clothes. Like, even just 2 weeks worth of clothes was, like, a ton. And so what we'd do is my brother and I would go to school, and we'd get home from school, and by home from school, I mean we'd walk out the doors, and we'd go get in our van, and we'd drive somewhere to go eat. We'd go to McDonald's, or we'd go to another fast food restaurant. We'd pick up, like, some sandwiches from a deli somewhere, or we'd make sandwiches, and we'd spread out a blanket in the park and pretend we're having a picnic as opposed to just eating on the grass because it's the only place we could eat. And then we'd do our homework. My mom would help us with our homework. We'd go pick up my dad from work at, like, 11 p.m. And we'd go sit in usually the elementary school parking lot and sleep there overnight, and then get up the next morning and go to school. And most weekends we would go to either a hotel where we could do our laundry and take showers for the first time in a fucking week, or we'd go to my grandparents' house. And my grandparents' situation with, it's hard to explain, like, how and why my grandparents didn't do more in this situation. Part of it was, like, literally trying to tell my mom, hey, get your fucking act together, because we can't keep facilitating this sort of thing happening. And part of it was, like, my grandmother had just been diagnosed with ALS, and they were going through a lot of shit with that, obviously. But for 2 months, that was basically it. And we were very fortunate to, A, have a car, and B, like, it happened to us during a period of time that was, like, pretty warm, relatively, like, during the fall. So it's not like we were, you know, sleeping out on the streets in the snow. But that was homelessness period A in my life. And then fast forward a little more than 10 years during college, in between my sophomore and junior years of college, this is at Berea College, a wonderful little place tucked into the hills of Kentucky and in Berea, Kentucky. I was staying in Berea over the summer, and I had very much a lot of difficulty trying to locate an apartment. It's a pretty small town, and by the time, like, you start looking for a place to stay, like, a lot of those places are already filled by people who are already staying there. And it was very difficult. And eventually I just decided, hey, I'm going to live on campus, because that was a possibility. It was just very expensive and I'd have to work a lot to do that. But a friend of mine was going to be sleeping in his car because he couldn't find a place to stay either and couldn't afford to stay on campus. So he was just going to like stay in his car. And because I had been homeless before, I gave him some pointers and he and I got pretty close over that. But like the first week of staying on campus that summer, I finally found a place that was like 30 minutes outside of town. It was like a shitty little loft apartment above a barn, and it didn't have like air conditioning or internet access or anything, but it was a place to stay. And we were like, you know what? Like, it's better than you being homeless. It's better than me paying out the ass to like stay on campus. So let's give this a go. And the unfortunate fact of the situation was like, he did not have the money to be able to like pay rent and especially pay gas money, because like he was the one driving us back and forth. And like, I swear to God, 4 days into us living there, he's like, yeah, this isn't going to work. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I don't have the money to keep doing this. And I'm like, well, I certainly don't have the money to do it by myself. And I don't have a vehicle with which to drive 30 minutes into town. I'm not walking it because it's the fucking mountains. We're in Appalachia here. So we called our landlord and he was super pissed and he threatened to sue us, but he didn't end up suing us, the sweet old man. And that just started me being homeless for a couple months again, until I was able to like scrounge up enough money and find a house, because some like trying to get his ethnicity right. I think he was Somalian. Some Somalian kid was going on an internship the second half of the summer and was going to be moving out of the place that he was in. And I moved in with the people who were living with him at the time. But for like 6-7 weeks, I was just like chilling in Berea, Kentucky, eating out of dumpsters, sleeping in bathrooms mostly. It's a good place to sleep because you get some privacy, and in the middle of the night, most people aren't necessarily going to the bathroom in like gas stations or public buildings on campus. Mostly eating pizza because there was a Little Caesars in town. And if you guys weren't in the know, Little Caesars, if they make the hot and ready pizzas, and if they don't sell them by the end of the night, they just throw them out. And more often than not, they just throw them out in the box. And so you can score some free pizza that way. And like, that's a steady supply of food. So like for 6-7 weeks, just sat in gas station bathrooms in the middle of the night and I ate pizza. And I went to work during the day at the recycling center there in the college, the best job I've ever had. And that was just my life.
In your pursuit of happiness, when you take a look back,
love that movie.
Yeah, it was. Oh man, whew, it was
makes me cry every time.
For these moments, again, a trying time in your life that you're describing, in both situations, are there any moments that you look back and you say, "Oh man, that was really good during that time"? Are there any positive things that really stand out where you look back fondly? Perhaps your family became closer during that time, or you really developed a really good friendship during another time. Just any stories, even the picnic. Sure. I've never been on a picnic with my mom and dad. So I think that even while listening to your story and understanding that obviously this wasn't a positive time, I think that being able to have a picnic and say, hey guys, we're having a picnic, versus dealing with the reality, that little moment of escapism and being able to romanticize and really appreciate something that a few weeks ago was pretty much the mundane of just really having dinner with your family at a dinner table. But now it's kind of a little bit more special, perhaps more exciting in some aspect, because you guys are having a picnic.
There's sort of two moments that, I mean, this is an interesting question. I don't think I've ever thought about this, but there are two moments in each of those periods of my life that do stand out as like really nice affirmative moments. The first time when I was like 8 years old, maybe seven, I don't know. You sort of struggle to fill the hours when you're homeless, because like, more than anything, more than being hungry, more than being cold, you're just so fucking bored all the time. And it's hard to fill those hours. And one of the ways that we did it was by going to the public library, because the public library is open for huge swaths of time during the day and is free for everyone. And you can like check out books, and not even just books. You can do like movies and CDs and books on audio tape and things like that. And I couldn't do that, but I could get books because, you know, there's still like daylight hours. I could still read. And we spent a lot of time in the library, and that was like some of the first periods of time in my life in which I spent like a long time just reading and just trying to get smarter as well as just more worldly. And like that was a very special thing for me. And I honest to God would be dead today if not for the public library in Crawfordsville, Indiana, because like it was such a place that I could escape to. Later in to tie this all back around to wrestling, because this is vaguely a wrestling podcast on PTBN. Later in 2013, when I was homeless for the second time, I had already been a wrestling fan for several years at that point. In 2013, like obviously because of this homelessness, but also other things like the insomnia and just like the kind of, I don't know, the kind of interpersonal relationship foibles you have when you're a young person. 2013 was a real weird year of my life, and it was also sort of a weird year in wrestling, and like I sort of fell out of wrestling in some ways, and the big matches during that year, especially in like New Japan, weren't things that really hit home with me. But I was still very much a Dragon Gate fan, and that was something that like had always been central to my understanding of wrestling, was Dragon Gate and this promotion. And I really loved Shingo Takagi, and in 2013 he ended Shima's like 2-year-long reign with the Open the Dream Gate title. And it was sort of like telegraphed the whole time. I think if you saw the build going up to it, you would understand that it was going to happen. And I understood, like, keeping up with the internet, what I could get on the internet while I was homeless. I understood that was going to happen. So like I saved up a little bit of money and I bought the pay-per-view on Nico Nico. And instead of like going to like actual dinner someplace for one day, I watched I watched Kobe World 2013, and I watched one of my favorite wrestlers win this big title and have like a formative moment in his career. And like that was that helped. It's one of those little moments that like throughout hardships in your life that like really helps you get through things.
Yeah, that's wow. There's a lot there. I mean, As I listen to you talk about it, it dawns on me, it's so interesting that homelessness sounds in a lot of ways a lot like being in prison. You know, You're like, you're imprisoned by your lack of somewhere to be. Well, prison, you're like forced to be only in this place inside, and homelessness is like you're forced to not ever have your own place to be inside by, you know. It's just,
you can't, like think of, I presume you're both recording this both in your own homes, right?
Yes.
Correct. Yeah.
So like you feel at ease there. You feel comfortable like sitting there and talking to some relative strangers or some friends on the internet for hours at a time. You feel, you're probably wearing comfortable clothes. Like it's a place that you can be.
Just my boxers.
Sure. But it's a place you can be you. You have the freedom to wear your boxers. But like when you're homeless, you don't have that kind of thing. And you always have to be on the lookout for like cops. You have to be on the lookout for just people or things or situations that can bring harm to you. And it's hard to get out of that too. Like it's hard to, when you haven't like showered for 3 weeks, it's hard to get a job. It's hard to like, to find a place to sleep or to like apply for an apartment when the landlord's like, oh, you look really scuzzy, brother. It's a difficult situation to get out of, and like part of why I'm so open about it is because it's a very much misunderstood thing, and people don't understand like the various layers and levels of homelessness or what they can do to help people in those situations. And like I kind of like to speak out about it because I can be a positive voice in that very confusing part of life.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And being in California, as I listen to you, and you know, you say you're in Kentucky, and the first time that you were homeless, I for some reason don't remember where you said you were exactly, but
Indiana, central Indiana, small town, Indiana.
And I mean, just the way that it sounds, I mean, me being in California, I'm like, they told you you had 4 hours to move out or whatever, 2 hours to
10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Four hours. Fuck you.
What? You know, no, I'm just like
twice we've been kicked out of our home. The second time, they gave us a day, which was very, very nice. But the first time, I think the situation had just become so unbearable that the landlord was like, you need to get out now.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah.
I mean, here, California now, I mean, it's 90 days minimum. And that's mm-hmm. after they've already talked to you a bunch and exhausted every other resource. So
they had... I guess they had done that, but I was a child. And so that was like, I guess I didn't know about that. I wasn't seeing that.
Right. I guess that's possible as well. And then, there's so much more help out here. And it makes you, I mean, being in Los Angeles, which is weird in its own way, but like it makes you blind to so many things, because when you hear about what it's like in other places, I kind of go like, what, they can't do that, they're not allowed to do that to you.
It's sort of easier in some ways, not necessarily in all ways, and it's definitely harder in some ways, but it's sort of easier in larger cities because like there are homeless shelters and there's soup kitchens. Like there wasn't a food shelter in my hometown the first time I was homeless. There was when I was going to school, when I was going to college in Kentucky, but like there wasn't a homeless shelter for, I want to say 30, 40 miles around of either one of those towns. And like, that's, you can't traverse that distance when you're homeless, you know, that's a whole nother world to you. So like, you're sort of just stuck, you're trapped.
Yeah, no, that is the case. I guess neither one of those sound like they were long periods of time per se.
But
because I try to think, like, where does everything else in life with the wrestling fandom, backyard wrestling, all that come in? But you weren't homeless for big times. So I guess a month or two of not being able to watch wrestling and ordering Nico Nico. I don't know. Where did you watch that pay-per-view? That's the question. At the library?
No, I was very lucky. There was one building on campus that had to stay open 24 hours a day due to that's where the public safety security guards on campus worked, and that's where their office was. So they had to keep that building open 24 hours a day, and they had to keep like certain parts of it lit 24 hours a day. And that was an air conditioned building that had Wi-Fi, and like that's where I stayed a lot.
Okay, well, I guess that makes sense. And
I was very lucky. Like that sort of thing isn't open to a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like you had, in some ways, I mean, it's obviously tough ordeal to have gone through, but in other ways you were very lucky that you got to come out of it on the other side pretty much unscathed, I would say.
Sure.
Come across
sure.
that way.
I'm still alive. Like,
yeah.
That's...
So, I mean, where...
Real downer podcast here, too.
No, I love it. where does kind of coming to grips with your sexuality kind of play in? Does it play into any of that? I mean, or... That's
an interesting question, because yeah. a large portion of LGBT teens do find themselves homeless at some point in their lives for a variety of reasons, and a large portion of just people who are homeless in general are LGBT. Though, like, it's interesting that those never, like, the first time, obviously, like, I'm 8 years old, I don't know shit about sex yet. Though I was smartened up to sex very early in my life due to internet porn. The second period of life, or the second period of time in my life in which I was homeless, I was very much a sexual being. But it's it's hard to get laid when you haven't showered in a long time, you know what I mean?
Exactly. That's kind of my question.
It just never entered into it, I guess. There was just the summer I didn't fuck anybody.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that... so many... people, and I, you know, I'm not trying to cast aspersions on anyone, because fuck it, get you or whatever, but there's so sure. many people who in the community could find a way to, you know what I mean, like use their sexuality to have advanced their station in life.
It's,
is somewhat
yeah that's a fucking fact of life, that like sometimes you have to make that hard decision to do something like that, and I didn't have to, and I never felt the pressure to do that. I was offered to sell drugs several times throughout college, and like looking back, I probably should have taken that offer up, but I turned it down every time. But yeah, like sometimes you have to make hard calls when you're homeless, when you're done, and you're like,
goddamn straight edge drug dealer, you'd never have to worry about getting high on your own supply.
That's what they thought. Like they were like, shit, dude, I can trust you. Like you're a cool kid. Like
that's genius. That's good.
I could have been making good money in college.
That's it. So, I mean, so by college, you obviously were, I mean, you described yourself as bisexual. I don't necessarily know, you know, what that entails for you personally, nor do I necessarily need to get into it. But by college, you were pretty firmly in that camp, or were you still questioning?
No, actually. Throughout high school, I'd only ever had sex with women. And I had only ever really felt like strong attraction to women. And I wasn't sure if like what I was feeling towards men was necessarily like a sexual thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know? But like when I got more into college and I like, obviously there's a wider swath of people when you get into college, like people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all genders and creeds and ethnicities. And I was just exposed to more people who sort of felt my way or had felt my way at one point in life and were very open to me. And like there were people who were very attracted to me, and were like, hey, do you want to do a thing? You want to hook up? And I was like, I don't know. Like we could just do it and see how it works. And they're like, yeah, fine. And sort of like, you get into it there and you take a swing at something and see if you like it. And then you realize, hey, I like this a lot. And that's just how it starts.
Yeah, no, I unfortunately didn't have the college experience, and it was kind of interesting because to me you've always come across as pretty well read, and knowing that it kind of came from spending a lot of time at the library, it's just it's so interesting because I think a lot of people that doesn't cross their mind, you know, as I talked about, you know, prison and homelessness, where that's where people have time to read all these books and then kind of come across and composite these eloquent conversation pieces and do the work that you do with the articles.
It's so funny you describe me as eloquent, because like this was another thing that I thought about talking about with you, and I suppose I could talk about this to a degree. I have a speech impediment. I've had a speech impediment my whole life. My brother has had it as well. It's just been something we were born with. And for the first parts of our lives, like the first 10 years or so for each of us, he's 2 to 3 years younger than me, depending on what time of year it is. For the first like 10 years of our lives, we couldn't make ourselves understood to other people. Like we had stutters, we had lisps. His was especially bad. He sounds like a drunken 70-year-old man from Boston. Like it's so weird that this kid who was raised in central Indiana sounded like an old Boston fuck. So funny. But like he couldn't make himself understood, and I couldn't make myself understood to like people outside of our immediate family. And so we kind of struggled in school because of that, and we had to go into like speech therapy, and really like had to work through how to speak and how to communicate with other people. And sort of when you grow up with a speech impediment, this isn't true for everyone, but when you grow up with like difficulties in communicating with people, you sometimes get left behind. And like it's difficult to form the bonds you have with other people when you can't speak to them. You don't make friends because you can't talk to them about like the Gundam Seed episode you watched late last night or something, you know? Like it's a hard thing to do, to grow up as a kid and feel so alone because like you can't talk to anybody else. And like just imagine how difficult it is for like ESL speakers who like are literally speaking a different language entirely. And so like we grew up with these speech impediments, and like when I slowly grew out of that, and it's still something that like it pops up in my life every once in a while, especially when I get upset. When we slowly grew out of that, it became clear to us that like we wanted to not only use our newfound voices, because like imagine what that's like. Imagine like you grew up blind and suddenly you can see again, or imagine you grew up paraplegic and suddenly your legs work again. Like you want to look at the entire world, or you want to like run around all day. And that's sort of how we were as kids when we could speak and make ourselves understood. Like we were so loud and we were so obnoxious because we had to make up for lost time of 10 years of not like not having conversations with other people. And like, that was a very difficult thing to get past. But we slowly began to realize that like, we both wanted to make sure that our words meant something. And for him, that meant like, for my brother, I mean, that meant like getting into like philosophical things and getting into mathematical things and talking about like important topics. And for me, that meant like becoming a good speaker and getting into like public speaking and radio broadcasting and acting and things that I did throughout high school and college quite a bit. And it really means a lot to me when people describe me as eloquent, because like, and it really means a lot to me too that people describe me as a good writer, which I believe even less than the fact that I'm eloquent. because like, I remember who I was as like an 8-year-old kid who's homeless and can't talk to other people because like he slurs his words. And to go from that kid to someone who like strangers on the internet say is like well-read and well-spoken and very intelligent, like that means the world to me, you know what I mean? And I just want to say thank you, Tim. That's a very kind thing for you to say.
Oh, no problem, Brock.
Hey, Brock, I have a question here. So obviously, again, I just see everything that you say, just the little things, it just paints a bigger picture.
Sure.
And obviously using the theater and art to express yourself where words failed you in traditional conversation. One thing that a lot of people do not know about me, and I didn't have a speech impediment, mm-hmm. but at some point in time in my life in middle school, it was hard for me to talk to people. And so I understand what you mean by being left behind, not necessarily academically, but socially. And I remember in my instance, it got so bad that I remember sitting down, we were in class and we had some free time, and there was a guy, another kid at the time, obviously we're both kids, and he was just talking to me, just a regular conversation. And I could not form basic responses mm-hmm. to this kid. I just couldn't talk to him. And I remember, and this is a guy that I spoke to before, and you know, it wasn't a high pressure situation. I wasn't trying to impress anyone to get into the local gang or anything
sure.
like that. And I just remember telling myself that evening, I will never allow that to happen to me again. I'll never be afraid to talk to someone. Mm-hmm. And I will never get to a point where I can't talk to someone. And this was eighth grade, so long ago. And fast forward to today, and people say, oh, well, you have a nice voice and you're a good conversationalist. For you specifically, with your speech impediment, again, I know you said you got involved in the arts and theater and whatnot, mm-hmm. but is there any moment, or any incident, or perhaps a series of incidents that began moving you and your brother into, and more specifically you, into the conversationalist that you are today?
I don't think it was ever so much as like an aha moment. Like, you know, life isn't like the movies where like just suddenly it all clicks together and everything's fixed. It was more like a series of slow changes over the years, and suddenly you just wake up one day and you're like, oh wow, I can like have a conversation with another human being, and they understand me. They don't just hear and register the words that I'm saying. Like they know what I'm saying. And it was never really an event in my life that was like that, at least not with the English language. I learned Spanish throughout high school and college, and I still speak a little bit of it. I haven't spoken much of it in years. I've lost a lot of it. I need to get back on that. But like, there was a period in time when I was learning Spanish that like my teacher was just talking to us in Spanish in class one day, and like I realized I wasn't translating words in my head, that I just was understanding what he was saying, and that blew my mind. Like, it made my whole week.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that you were that far into the bilingualism.
I tested out of 100 level and 200 level Spanish courses my freshman year, and I went right into 300 level. And if I had taken one more class during my time in college, I would have qualified for a Spanish minor.
Ah, nice.
The old Spanish minor still paying off. One of the things I can just tell you, and Tim, you can kick in shortly, as far as Spanish is concerned, I was dropped mm-hmm. off in the middle of Santo Domingo. Trust me, it all comes back when you need
sure.
it.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, it's a pretty English, it's a pretty...
When your life depends on it, it will come
definitely. You can never discount what fear does to you, but it's a pretty easy language to pick up, and like it's easier to make yourself understood in Spanish than most people think it is.
Well, I find myself in a, I guess, rather common conundrum on this show, but for some reason I feel more exacerbated than ever, because I don't want this to ever end, but it has to. Again, as I talked about the silent PTBN benefactor before, he did have another kind of question or query or thought that he was interested in, so I have to put that out there before I let you go, which was, out of all the wrestling companies, and you talked about Dragon Gate there, so I almost feel like it's out ahead, but you seem to have an emotional connection to wrestling companies in a way that a lot of other people kind of tend to do with wrestlers.
Uh-huh.
Is there one that you think you hold premier nostalgia to? Or,
oh, yeah.
Okay, I was going to even say, maybe there's different forms of nostalgia, like nostalgia as a fan, nostalgia as someone who did, you know, nostalgia even for a company that maybe you know people who are involved in it, but
sure.
you know what it is, so let's just get into it. What is it?
Well, I do, like I mentioned Dragon Gate before, I've been watching Dragon Gate for a long time, so that's sort of one of them. PWG for a very long time was something that was like central to my understanding of professional wrestling, and while it's changed over the years, it's still something I love very much. Beyond Wrestling is a place that like I've seen grown from its first days, and it's been populated by people who I know and love and people who are friends, and like that's certainly a place, but above all else, there's one promotion in my life that stands the test of time and that I don't think I'm ever going to stop watching for
TNA.
Any... No, it's not TNA. It's worse than TNA. It's a terrible place. It has done a lot of bad things to a lot of good people, and it's completely reprehensible, but I love CZW. It's hard to describe why. It's like sort of subversive. It plays to parts of me that a lot of people don't see, like the skateboarder in me. I'm very much into skateboarding. That doesn't come out a lot. It plays to like my punk aspects and my underground aspects. I like the violence of it. Like, I really love death matches. There's a Psychology is Dead episode that I did with Quentin about death matches that I think is really good and got a lot of good feedback. And I talk more about that there, but like, there's something about the black and yellow that draws me in. And like, even when it's run by horrible people, and even when they do terrible things, both in kayfabe and in reality, and even when their fans are just fucking garbage, it's I love it, you know.
Oh yeah.
So let me ask you this, Brock. Again, Benoit turned a lot of diehard WWE fans off of WWE. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that CZW could do, or the owner could do, before you say, hey, you know what? I'm done. I'm turning in my shirt. I'm deleting all my DVDs. I'm out of here.
I don't know. It's hard because, like, when I discovered CZW on YouTube. I watched this music video, which I have saved on my computer. I think it's still on YouTube, but if need be, I'll upload it. Dear listener, if you want to see it, ask me about it. I watched this music video that was set to Fear of the Dark by Iron Maiden, and it repulsed me entirely. I was still a very new wrestling fan. I was still very much beholden to like WWE and that style, and to see people like light each other on fire and roll bowling balls into each other's crotches and go through glass and barbed wire, I hated it, but something in it drew me back in, and I came back around to it. So like, it turned me off from the beginning, and they've done a lot of terrible things over the years, but like, it's hard to say before it happens if there will be anything that'll turn me off. Like, I think I've never loved IWA Mid-South, especially not when I worked for them, but like the whole Mike Levy incident with Ian Rotten was one thing that I'd probably, like, if I had been a IWA Mid-South guy, I would have stopped, like, caring, and I would have turned away. But like, CZW hasn't done anything yet, but fingers crossed that they won't do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's I was gonna say I knew that you bleed black and yellow, but I mean, it's so hard to say. I mean, CZW has done almost everything bad.
Oh yeah, totally.
It's
totally
really hard to think they're gonna do anything worse at any point. I mean, I don't know.
And that's the thing, is like to circle back around to our discussions toward the beginning of this podcast, it's sort of like you have to understand that, like, those people doing terrible things aren't always terrible people, and like, that's a hard thing to understand, and you don't have to understand it, because like, you don't necessarily have to forgive people for the terrible things they do. Some things are just too far, and like, that's, I understand that. But like, I don't know, because CZW still at the end of the day brings me so much joy, and like, that's hard to forget.
Yeah, no, I guess in some ways I can relate to that. I can relate to a lot of stuff you said tonight, and I hope a lot of people listening can relate. No, I mean, really, can relate, and maybe if they don't relate, maybe they learn something and they see that stuff isn't
sure.
That. People aren't that weird, aren't that different. These things are just normal people, because I think anybody who reads your articles really enjoys them, and they may not realize...
Not everybody, but...
I think a good amount of people. Some people have even said it makes them want to jump off a bridge, because they're never going to read anything as good as that ever again. So that...
Well, that's not what Gabe said that, but...
Hey, you know what? Maybe it was. Who knows? But before we really go, because we had to go off on that last little diatribe... there is one thing I have to ask you, and unfortunately, because I don't have Adrian, I don't have the special effects, so it is time for the final question. Maybe we'll edit that in and post. The final question. Yeah, when Tom does it, it just doesn't have the same, I guess, echo effect is what it is.
There's no reverb.
Yeah. So, Brock, someone who only knows you from, let's say, your blog, Brock Hates Wrestling. Maybe they only know you from the Shrinks. You're almost a completely different guy on the Shrinks than you are in anywhere else. Maybe they only know you from reading your articles. What's something that would be shocking about Brock for them to find out?
So, when you... Okay, so I listen to this podcast. Like, I'm not a fake friend. I actually listen to my friend's podcast. And I was aware that this question was coming. And I was, in the days leading up to this, thinking about what I was going to answer this question with. And I came up with what I find to be a good answer, or what I think is a funny answer. But it's also an answer that could get us in a lot of trouble. And specifically, I think it's an answer that, like, would disqualify me from ever running for public office. And I spoke to you, Tim, about it, and used vague terms, and you said, well, we'll roll with it and we'll see how it goes. So here goes nothing. Back in middle school, it always returns to middle school. What formative years middle school is for most of us. Sometime in middle school, I want to say in seventh grade, I'm with my mom at Goodwill. And during this period of time, due to, I don't want to go on a whole diatribe with this because it's another long story, and this is already a long podcast. In a roundabout way, due to my epilepsy and due to being very poor growing up, I had never really known what music was like. And then when I was 10 years old, I became aware of music, and I was able to buy music, and music became a very big part of my life. And in middle school, I got really into, like, punk music, and specifically straight edge music, because I had seen, like, what drugs and alcohol had done to my family, and what it had done to, like, my community as a large, and even as a young person, especially as a Christian person, which is an important thing to point out. I'm no longer Christian, but I was very religious at that time. It was very clear to me, even at a young age, that, like, I was going to be drug-free and alcohol-free for a very long time, at the very least, if not my whole life, because it was something I wasn't interested in. And so, this leads me to, sometime in seventh grade, I'm with my mother at Goodwill and we're, you know, flipping through shirts. And I see the shirt that has like some logo on it. I don't remember what the logo was on the front of it, but the tag on the collar read, "Kill your local drug dealer," and had a little drawing of a Luger, like the German handgun. And I was like, whoa, this is cool. I don't like drug dealers. Drugs are bad. Like, straight edge forever. If you're not now, you never were. And so I grab it, and I grab it by the collar so that my mom doesn't see the tag. And I'm like, hey, mom, can we get this? And she's like, sure, what the fuck ever. And she buys me this shirt, and I wear it to school, and I wear it for the next couple of years until I grow out of it, and I throw it away, or I send it back to Goodwill or whatever. And I don't think about it for like a decade. And then 3 weeks ago or so, I can't believe I'm telling this story. Literally one person in the world knows about the story other than me. And I'm about to share it to the internet.
You won't tell anyone.
Sure, totally. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. I'm very appreciative of your friendship here. I think about the shirt for the first time in like 10 fucking years. And I'm like, let's see what that brand was about. Let's see if I can find it. And I search "kill your local drug dealer shirt" on DuckDuckGo, fuck Google. And I find this website where they're selling these shirts, and it has the Luger symbol on it. And I'm like, ah, cool. I found this again. And it says it's affiliated with something called like Tightrope Records. And I was like, oh, okay. Oh. It's a record label of some kind. And then I take more than a cursory glance at the website. And at the top, it has this banner that reads, "It's not illegal to be white yet." And I go, oh, God. And I navigate to the homepage, and I see they're selling flags with the swastika on them. And I go, oh, my God. This is like a white supremacy website. And it slowly dawns on me that, like, I was wearing a white supremacy branded piece of clothing when I was in middle school. And I couldn't fucking wrap my brain around it. And I messaged my best friend, and I was like, dude, you got to talk me out of this. Cause like, I don't remember what the logo on the front was, but like, I'm scared to death. I was walking around school with a shirt that read like 1488 or some shit. And like, it couldn't have been that bad because I got through school with it. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe like the people in central Indiana didn't know what they were fucking looking at with that kind of shirt. But like, I unknowingly in middle school was wearing like some Nazi clothing. And that's something I guarantee you no one knew about me.
Yeah. Wow, Rock.
Yeah. Wow. And I just found out about that a couple weeks ago, and turned my whole life around.
Yeah, well, now you gotta, I mean, that's why you have to take the time to look up these brands before you start supporting them. There are no sidelines anymore, people.
I was like 11 years old. I didn't have internet. I couldn't
You have to start wearing hip clothes that vegans and hippies grow out in their backyards and in the middle of the woods.
Wear
hemp. So this podcast is supported by hemp. We're all wearing hemp. Mm-hmm. And we're going to wear hemp, and so should you. I want to chime in here, Brock. I know Tim, he does his final question, but I kind of have a final question. The guest's final question. Hopefully there's a gimmick that goes with that. The guest! Final question. I don't know. I can't do a voice.
Sure.
There's going to be a lot of posts on this episode.
There's going to be a lot of editing done. So let me ask you just real general question here.
Okay.
Let's say you meet your soulmate, and we're going to do a Klosterman style here. You meet your soulmate, however, there's a catch. Every 3 years, someone will break both of your soulmate's collarbones, the crescent wrench, and there's only one way you can stop this from happening. You must swallow a pill. However, when you swallow this pill, every song that you hear for the rest of your life will sound like is sung by Kiss's lead singer, Paul Stanley. So when you hear on the radio Katy Perry, it will sound to you, and just you only, like it's being played by Kiss. If you see Radiohead live, every one of their tunes will sound like it's being covered by Kiss. When you hear a commercial jingle on TV, it will sound like Kiss. If you sing to yourself in the shower,
oh no,
your voice will sound like Paul Stanley, the lead singer of Kiss, performing a cappella. However, it will only sound like that to you.
Oh.
Would you swallow this pill?
Okay, so this is for the rest of my life, correct?
This is for the rest of your life. Every 3 years, you're going to have to re-up any song that you hear, even if it's coming from yourself, any music, commercials, doesn't matter. All sounds like Paul Stanley from Kiss. All the riffs of any song, it all sounds like Kiss. Mm. Would you take this pill?
And this is going to happen to my soulmate every 3 years if I don't take this pill.
Every 3 years, someone's going to come up, and they're going to give you the option to take the pill or they break the collarbones. You get to decide.
That's so rough. Like, you chose, like, one of the worst bones you could break. You really thought this through. And it's like I have a person who I at least thought at one point was my soulmate, and I'm imagining her in the situation, and like it's bringing me a lot of torment at the moment. Tom, thank you. I don't like hate Paul Stanley or Kiss all that much. Like, they've got some kitschy elements that I really enjoy, but like
everything.
Yeah, that's the thing.
That's
like
the problem.
When I listen to the Mountain Goats, like, it'd have to be Paul Stanley. When I listen to fucking like Interpol or whoever, like, it'd have to be Paul Stanley. Like, the whole when you sing yourself, it'd have to be Paul Stanley. That's the real fucking kicker there too. Oh man. And like, theoretically, like, my soulmate's voice would have to be the same way. Like, music is such a big part of my life. Like, it would be so hard, but I've already caused so much pain in this poor girl's life that I couldn't keep doing that willingly. And so, yeah, I think I'd have to bite the bullet and take this pill and just sort of lose, like, this whole part of my life that's very important to me. That's a tough question, Tom.
So, Tim, I'm sorry, wrong movie. Tim, what would you do?
Oh, jeez.
You're married, so, like, this is a whole different thing for you.
Well, I have good health care. That's the thing. I have good insurance, too. So, but the thing is, I don't listen to a lot of music, so it's kind of, it's not as much of a Sophie's choice for me. Here's the question. Do I have instant choice? Like, I got to choose right now between the two, and then again in 3 years?
Yeah, like, every 3 years, you get a choice.
So I couldn't say...
Alternate. You talk to your wife, and you're like, hey, sit this one out for 3 years, honey. Like, I want to listen to music.
Yeah, like, I could alternate, I could switch. I couldn't, but I can't give the guy, like, I can't wait. I can't be like, give me 6 months, and then I'll take the... I guess I got the 3 years.
No, you have maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes to make a decision.
5 minutes, okay. And during the 5 minutes, have the effects of the last pill worn off?
No.
Okay, so my choices are broken collarbones every 3 years or a life where I never hear anything but Paul Stanley.
Correct.
Okay.
If you take the collarbones, like, you're re-breaking old bones, and like, as you get older, like, you can't be doing that shit.
Yeah, it'll just get worse and worse over time. I mean, I probably wouldn't switch back and forth. Maybe you could take 1 3-year abeyance, but I'd probably go with the Paul Stanley because I don't listen to a lot of music, honestly.
Okay, well, that's
and cool. Also, I like my wife enough.
Oh yes,
enough. Is this just Paul Stanley? It's not the backing vocals of
Gene Simmons, Ace Frehley. It's the whole nine yards.
Okay,
yeah,
okay, it's
the
all
whole
three
nine yards. Yeah, and Chris as well. Peter Criss on drums.
Peter Criss. Does he sing? I don't remember. I don't listen to Kiss, actually.
Hard Luck Woman, Black Diamond.
I think the only one who doesn't sing is Ace Frehley. Does he sing? I don't think he does.
No, he does. He did New York Groove. He did Back in the New York Groove.
Oh, yeah, he did. You're right.
That was him. Yep.
I completely forgot about that. All right. Well, Tom, you always have these very awesome questions. I love them so much. Brock,
I guess thank you for allowing me
thank you
to have a conversation with you, the space ghost of sports entertainment podcasting. That is you, my friend. That is not me. And Tim, thank you very much for taking your time and allowing me into your house, muddy shoes and all.
Well, thank you so much, Tom Cheese. You do such a good job. I mean, you're such an orator, really. Thank you, Brock. If there's anything you want to plug out there that we haven't already talked about, feel free to do it now.
Sure. I do want to just say thank you both for having me on. But if you like the sound of my voice and you'd like to hear more of it, or maybe the person behind it, you can find me on Twitter at NotBrockYonke. That's spelled NotBrockJahnke. I write for Wrestling With Words. You can find my podcast on that website called Sports Entertainment Shrinks. It's me and a couple of my friends just talking about whatever we fancy in the world of wrestling. I write for Wrestling With Words, usually under the Brock Hates Wrestling banner, and I also have a blog spot under that same name, Brock Hates Wrestling. It's just about everything that you can find me under. I'm here on PTBN with Quentin sometimes on his Psychology Is Dead podcast. Be sure to listen to that. He's a great person. Listen to the stuff that Tim and Tom here put out. Like, there's plenty of great stuff on PTBN and on Wrestling With Words and on Voices of Wrestling too. Shit, let's not be partisan about this. Like, there's plenty of good wrestling writing and great wrestling podcasting out there. And don't limit yourself to only what you know or what you think you might like. Like, branch out a little bit and see what's out there.
Thanks for that, Brock. That's a great point, and I echo it as much as possible. Tom, anything you want to plug before we get out of here?
Absolutely not. Except for the Military Industrial Suplex. I'm the host of the Military Industrial Suplex podcast. You can find that on the Place to Be Pro Wrestling Only SoundCloud feed. Mm-hmm. I also have a Twitter that I am still edging myself into using. MIS Podcast. That's at MIS Podcast. And episode six. Paris Is Burning with Stephen Graham is currently up. A very fun talk I had with him. More to come. And yeah, that's mainly it.
Yeah, I mean, Military Industrial Suplex has quickly become the brand du jour for the new PTBO now that kind of Big Daddy Parv has disappeared and his reign of terror is over. And the new breed, the young bloods, have taken over on PWO. I mean, Tom, I love your podcast. I am an unabashed fanboy of your podcast. I think what you bring, your voice, and as I said, just your eloquent language, everything you do, fantastic. If people want to hear me do the same thing I'm doing here, which is kind of being somewhat more fragile, a little bit more introspective, and kind of giving other people a chance to talk about their experiences, go listen to my other podcast that just came out a couple days ago. We're Do It Live. I talked to Stephen Graham and Carl Mann about Smash Wrestling. It's a lot of fun. And I would say go grab that. I got another episode of We'll Do It Live coming out very shortly. At the beginning of the newest episode, I did say I've been being lazy, but I'm refocused. I've redoubled my energy, and I'm going to have another episode out within a couple weeks probably here. That one's got some exciting guests. I guess it's already recorded, so I can just say it. I've got Dylan Hales and the Lady J to talk about Nova Pro Wrestling, two people who are phenomenal, never done a podcast together before, so that's a big get for me until someone scoops me before I put this one out, which they probably will. So yeah, go check that out. Follow me on Twitter at Lucha Undead. I have another show this week in wrestling. You can check that out as well. But really, take a break from me. You get enough content from me if you're already listening to this. Go listen to Sports Entertainment Shrinks. Listen to Military Industrial Suplex. And just remember that the most important things in life are the three B's, which is good beers, good buds, and good Brock. Good night.
Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliot's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.